From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. President Trump renewed his attacks on the late John McCain this week. Meghan McCain envisioned her father's reaction.
I think if I had told my dad, 7 months after you're dead, you're going to be dominating the news and all over Twitter, he would think it was hilarious that our president was so jealous of him that he was dominating the news cycle in death as well.
Large swaths of the Midwest are still underwater, and the flooding is expected to continue well into spring. In Lehi, Iowa, water rushed into the home of Mark Craig Johnson. He spoke with KDSM-TV in Des Moines.
This is the highest I've ever seen it. Blew in my basement window, and we lost the battle. Probably come up 4 foot in 45 minutes.
And Boeing is under investigation after two deadly plane crashes. In fact, so is the FAA, the federal agency which is supposed to regulate Boeing. Reuters broke the story that pilots on the doomed Lion Air flight searched a handbook for a way to stop the plane from nosediving moments before the crash, leading to dramatic reports like this from CNN.
Scouring the operations manual for any explanation, apparently unaware they are battling an onboard computer that is forcing those dives.
Join us. What are your questions about the week's news? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter, Facebook, at onpointradio. Our Jack Beatty has the day off. With us from Des Moines is Kathy Obradovich. She's opinion editor and columnist for the Des Moines Register. Kathy, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, David. Great to be here.
Joining us from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, Darlene Superville. She's White House reporter for the Associated Press. Darlene, terrific to have you back.
Hi, David. Glad to join you.
And also chiming in here from Washington, D.C. is John Harwood, editor-at-large for CNBC and host of Speakeasy with John Harwood. John, glad you could join us.
Hey, David.
So let's start with our ringer from the Midwest. It gives us no pleasure. But Kathy, tell us a little bit about what's happening. As I understand it, it's now up to four or five states that have declared a state of emergency. How bad are these floods?
It is really, really bad, David. Our governor here in Iowa has declared 41 out of Iowa's 99 counties as disaster areas. They do that to try to get the federal aid process started. Vice President Pence flew into Omaha on Tuesday and pledged really quick assistance. That's all relative. Assistance is never really, really quick. But the water is still high. It's not receding. And because of record snowfalls that we've had, they really expect more coming. And people down the river in Missouri are going to be seeing this water as well. So it's a serious thing. And, here in Iowa, we have been having these record flooding events with increasing frequency. I live in Des Moines. The first year I moved here in 1993, we had record flooding that took out the water plant. We were without water for 11 days. Cedar Rapids, Des Moines had flooding again. And so we're seeing this with more and more regularity here in western Iowa. There are a host of other environmental issues that this flooding could cause, including flooding livestock operations and causing contamination because of the manure pits. It can wash all of our topsoil down the river, which affects farming. And you've got a farm economy that's struggling, holding on by its fingernails because of the tariffs and other commodity prices and other problems. So you've got a host of issues that are coming along with this flooding. We're just going to have to ride it out.
Kathy, Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor and Democratic presidential hopeful, is among those saying, look, folks, when you're looking at the future of climate change, we're seeing it right now happening in the Midwest, in our neighboring states and our communities. How is the conversation about that in Iowa, in the area? How much does that factor into how people think about this?
I think that it's still difficult to talk about climate change in any kind of constructive way. People will have a knee-jerk reaction when you say, oh, climate change is causing this latest weather disaster. And people, who aren't inclined and don't want to talk about climate change still don't want to talk about it. And furthermore, they push back, well, let's let people recover before we start thinking about this. It's not just climate change, though. I think it's decades of pushing water management, watershed management, flood management issues, just kicking them down the road. You've got some serious conversations coming between residents of Western Iowa and the Army Corps of Engineers about their engineers about their levees, for example, which are crumbling. So it's an infrastructure problem as well as a climate problem. And, you would think that a crisis like this would say, okay, this is bringing this issue to a head. We've got to address it. But it didn't happen after the floods of 93. It didn't happen in 2008 or 2015. So I don't know if this will really cause a serious change of mind or change of heart about these issues.
Darlene Superville, you covered the White House briefly. You know, the response in Washington to this is what?
Well, Kathy mentioned that Vice President Pence flew into the area on Tuesday of this week and did some surveying and promised quick assistance to deal with the flooding, which, as Kathy mentioned, quick assistance is relative. I think the big, sort of takeaway from the White House is that there's a lot of talk about climate change, and the White House is not a White House that believes in climate change. And just to add on what Kathy was saying earlier, the flooding there is also threatening Offutt Air Force Base in Nebraska. And mm-hmm. that air base is the home of Strategic Command, which, plays a big role in managing global threats. And while, the facility itself is not in danger right now, this is an example of how climate change is actually a national security threat. And that's something that the White House and most members of the administration have not yet bought into, and many members of Congress as well.
Even as I think I read last night a government report in which a federal scientist said something along the lines of climate change wasn't the sole driver of this, but it plays a key supporting role in the intensity and the duration of these floods. Darlene, I want to turn now to news from the White House. Yesterday, in an interview with the Fox Business Network, President Trump said he had decided to recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights and that was a decision that he had been considering for some time.
I've been thinking about doing it for a long time. It's been a very hard decision for every president. No president has done it.
He was then immediately praised by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, himself up for re-election in less than 3 weeks in a ton of political and legal troubles, and who has promoted his relationship with Trump as a reason that he should be allowed to stay in office.
He did it again. First, he recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital and move the U.S. embassy here. Then he pulled out of the disastrous Iran treaty. But now he did something of equal historic importance.
Darlene Superville, a lot of administrations have not recognized Israel's dominion over that territory. What does this mean?
One thing it means is that it shows the closeness between the current administration and Washington, the Trump administration, and Israel. Sarah Sanders, who is the White House press secretary, tweeted last night that President Trump is the most pro-Israel president ever. And remember last year he moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which was something that supporters of Israel and also the Prime Minister Netanyahu have wanted for some time. So that's another example of the closeness between the Trump administration and Benjamin Netanyahu, who is going to be in Washington early next week. He'll be at the White House on Monday for meetings, and then he'll be back on Tuesday for a private dinner with the president.
John Harwood, you've covered a lot of administrations. How does this affect the equilibrium in Middle Eastern politics, the American role in it, and the idea that the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, can somehow conjure up some sort of resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that he's been charged with?
Well, he's not going to come up with a solution. He says he's working on it, but the inextricable alignment between the Trump administration and the Netanyahu government, the decisions that we've been talking about on Golan Heights, on the embassy, on Iran, all of those things make it more difficult for the United States to play the role that it has attempted to play over the last couple of decades in trying to achieve peace in the region and a resolution to the plight of the Palestinians and the securing of Israel's future. So this is a political stance that Donald Trump has taken that is not likely to achieve the effect that they say they want, which is to achieve some sort of comprehensive agreement.
John, is this in some ways more candor from the White House than perhaps past administrations where, you know, there's always seemed to be an embrace of Israel as our, you know, democratic ally in the Middle East, sharing our values, a history that's important to uphold, but we're going to be an honest broker? Is this in some ways more sort of casting off the pretense and saying, look, we're on this side and yes, we'll, you know, we'll talk to countries that feel that they're or peoples that feel that they're in conflict somehow. But in reality, we're aligned in this way.
Well, it's more candid in the sense that this administration is not an honest broker as we've traditionally thought of it. But I think previous administrations did attempt to serve as honest brokers and try to achieve some sort of agreement. But it was funny yesterday in that Fox News interview, President Trump was asked by Maria Bartiromo, was this something that you did in order to help Bibi Netanyahu's reelection? And he said, no, no, I have no idea what's going on in his reelection. And then a minute later he said, I hear he's doing pretty well. So the president is all in with Bibi. That's the approach that he's taken since the campaign. And that is his prerogative as the leader of American foreign policy. It's simply not likely to result in the deal that Jared Kushner says he's working on.
You've been hearing from John Harwood, Darlene Superville, Kathy Obradovich. We want each of them to stay around. We want you to stay around. We're talking about the week in the news. Questions ahead about the president's rhetorical blasts at the husband of one of his aides and also about a dead United States senator. We'll be talking, too, about Jared Kushner and what's up with his WhatsApp and, of course, safety and Boeing. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week's top headlines. You can join our conversation about the president's Twitter tirades, his son-in-law Jared Kushner's private messaging with world leaders, and flight concerns about Boeing, about the FAA. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, Darlene Superville of the Associated Press, and John Harwood of CNBC. I got to say, there's a stretch during which I felt as though, and it is true, that we all focus too much on what the president has to say on Twitter. And yet I also have come to believe over the years that presidential rhetoric is part of leadership. So it is pretty notable that to think about what the president has spent his time talking about on Twitter in recent days. 7 months after John McCain's death, President Trump has renewed his attacks on the senator. He blamed McCain for war in the Middle East. He blamed McCain for ignoring the needs of veterans. And he complained that the McCain family did not thank him for approving details of McCain's memorial service. Here's the president on Wednesday speaking at a defense manufacturing plant in Ohio.
So I have to be honest, I've never liked them much. Hasn't been for me. I've really probably never will.
John Harwood, what is going on?
The president is somebody who cannot control his impulses. And his impulses have been at odds with John McCain for a long time. He criticized him from way back as John McCain emerged as a national figure, as a hero from his Vietnam service. Remember, President Trump did not serve in Vietnam, claimed numerous deferrals from the deferments from the draft, including one alleging that he had bone spurs. John McCain is celebrated for his heroism. He started in the campaign in 2015 by saying that John McCain wasn't a hero because he was captured, and he prefers people who weren't captured. Then John McCain, of course, cast the decisive vote to block the repeal of Obamacare, which is something that President Trump campaigned on extensively. That was seen as a signature failure for the Republican Party, and he cannot give it up. And in the process of prosecuting this particular grudge, he is proving the point that the husband of his top aide, Kellyanne Conway, George Conway, lawyer, could have been a top appointee in the Trump administration but backed out, has been making on Twitter, which is that the president has a his suggestion or argument is that Trump suffers from narcissistic personality disorder. And on this week, above all weeks, as George Conway put that on the table, the president's doing his best to make people think that Conway is right.
Georgia's Senator Johnny Isakson, one of the few Republican senators willing to criticize President Trump for going after John McCain, spoke about this to Georgia Public Broadcasting.
It's deplorable what he said. That's what I called it from the floor of the Senate 7 months ago. It will be deplorable 7 months from now if he says it again, and I will continue to speak out.
I'd like to take a call now from Nashville, Tennessee on this very topic. Carl, go ahead.
Well, I tell you, to give you a little background on me so I just don't come off as an angry caller, my maternal grandfather fought in World War II in the Army. My paternal grandfather fought in the Korean War and Vietnam. My father fought at the tip of the spear in Vietnam. He's a Marine. And to sit back and watch this racist coward and Donald Trump talk ill of the dead and an American hero, whether I agree with his politics or not, is sickening. And for us to allow this to go through like this is normal, that this is normal behavior of an adult, let alone a president of the United States, is I think it's a reflection on where we are as a society. And last but not least, Donald, we don't forget, we're not going to get distracted by this. You colluded with the Russians for your election. And even though you've thrown out all this Twitter distraction, we don't forget. And I guarantee you that Bob Mueller and the Southern District of New York does not forget.
Well, thank you for that, Carl. I appreciate that. One vote for this as distraction, but an offensive one. Darlene Supervielle, there has been a conversation ginned up by the wife of one of the president's closest – excuse me, the husband of one of the president's closest advisors. That is, Kellyanne Conway is his advisor. George Conway, a prominent figure in Republican legal circles, her husband, but has been online a very tough critic of the president, questioning not only his judgment but his soundness of mind. You know, it is, as our caller, Carl, said, this is not normal. As John Harwood said, this is not normal. And at the same time, I'm a little uncomfortable with armchair sort of theorizing from non-professionals at a distance on the president's state of mind. What do people in the White House do, not the president, but the aides that you talk to, the administration officials do when people say this isn't normal and questions like these are raised?
They kind of just shrug it off for the most part. I mean, you know, if you work for the president, it's kind of hard to come out and agree with his critics, right? They may secretly harbor opinions where they think, he shouldn't, for example, be going on these rants against John McCain 7 months after John McCain, who was someone everyone who follows the president closely as we do, we all know that he had a terrible relationship with John McCain, right? But, they may want to tell him, cut it out. Some of them may tell him, don't do it. But in the final analysis, President Trump is going to do what he wants to do. And I was on that trip to Ohio on Wednesday, and I was sitting there with my colleagues taking notes as he started to speak. And none of us expected him to go on such an extended diatribe against Senator McCain in front of that audience at that Army tank plant. It was quite stunning and unusual, to say the least. but you know, he's just going to do what he is going to do, and for some reason he felt yet another need to light into a deceased United States senator and American war hero the way he did.
David, let me just
John,
add to the,
John
the point that you made. I understand the reluctance to engage in armchair diagnosis, and I've shared that reluctance and was getting pelted with incoming from people in the psychiatric community during 2016. Why aren't you talking about this more? Why isn't the press making this a focus? And so I have no diagnostic ability whatsoever, but it doesn't take a medical degree to see that this is a president who is consumed with thoughts about himself and the effect of events on himself and the effect on other people on himself. That's just obvious from his moment-to-moment conduct. And the principal referent for the president in reacting to anything or anyone is how it affects him. Mm-hmm. I've never seen anything like it in politics, and whether that has a medical name or not, it is a reality about his life and his service as president.
And those within that field were the ones pressuring you to think about this. I feel as though, John, there's going to be some evolution of the old Bob Dylan line, it doesn't take a weatherman to know which way the wind is blowing.
Right.
We've got a call now, actually especially for Kathy Obradovich, from Iowa. Frank, go ahead. I understand you have a question for us.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. So, Kathy, I live in Ames, and I've been a big fan of your writing. I'm just wondering why it seems the latest Steve King meme has been, for lack of better, washed over.
And Frank, why don't you unpack for us what you mean about Steve King? What happened this week? I understand he made some comments lately, but what ones in particular are you pointing to?
Unfortunately, I can't about the specific one. I know that most of his district is underwater thanks to the flooding in western Iowa.
All right. Well, why don't we hop then and let Kathy address that? Steve King did seem to get weighed back into metaphoric waters once more with some comments, I believe, about race. What happened this week, and what was the reaction to him there?
Yeah, Frank, first of all, shout out to fellow Ames person and Go Cyclones. They play tonight in the NCAA tournament, so glad to hear from somebody from Ames. Steve King, it's hard to keep up. We actually had an editorial written that's supposed to run in Saturday's paper talking about Steve King retweeting a meme that talked about a civil war between blue states and red states. And, you know, that the red states have 8 trillion bullets and the blue states don't know which bathroom to use. And he got a lot of pushback for glorifying violence and, you know, talking about, civil war and the idea that blue states and red states, couldn't actually work out their differences. But before we could even get into the paper with that, he was already having town halls and stirring up more trouble. He was asked about whether he thought an all-white society would be better than a diverse society. And he basically just said, well, that's a hypothetical question. I can't address that. And before we could even react to that, here he is now saying that Hurricane Katrina victims, he's demonizing them, Hurricane Katrina victims are just sitting around begging for help while people in Western Iowa are helping each other. And, you know, that was taken as being racist and certainly very insulting to people from New Orleans who were in a totally different situation than people in Iowa are right now with flooding. So it's very hard to keep up with the latest Steve King outrage, first of all. And the other question is, so we saw Joni Ernst come in with Mike with Vice
Senator
Pence. And where was Steve King? This is his district. You're right. I think that's a really good question.
Sounds as though that the vice president may want to be many, many hemispheres and planets away from Steve King at this.
Even Joni Ernst, she had said that finally that Steve King had gone over the line last year around election time as well. So I think that Steve is kind of persona non grata with the top people in his party right now.
Speaking of top people in Republican Party circles, Jared Kushner, the president's senior advisor, his son-in-law, has been designated point person by the president on a whole host of things, including, as we mentioned earlier, the Middle East. Nonetheless, he's now under tough scrutiny by Democrats on Capitol Hill over his use of WhatsApp and his private messaging. Darlene Superville, what's the problem with that?
Well, the chairman of the House Oversight Committee, Congressman Elijah Cummings from Maryland, says that the use of this app, WhatsApp, to communicate with world leaders or just people outside of the U.S. government just raises a whole bunch of national security questions and also concerns about federal record keeping, keeping track, documenting these communications the way you would, for example, save an email that's sent, the way that Jared Kushner might save an email that's sent to him on a White House computer. You have to save that under the records preservation laws. How do you do that when you're using an app to communicate?
You know, on the hypocrisy scale of 1 to 10, given the clamor about Hillary Clinton's use of private email server, it would seem that this would register in the upper 30s. Doesn't seem to concern anybody at the White House, though, right?
Well, the president got asked about it this morning. You know, he's in the air right now heading down to Florida, his home in Palm Beach, for the weekend. And he was asked about Jared Kushner and the use of WhatsApp. And the president said he didn't know anything about it. So it seems to have landed at the White House with sort of a collective thud. And this was pretty much the same response earlier or last year when it came to light that Ivanka Trump may have been using a personal email account and not properly saving her correspondence. Also, it was the same kind of response.
I want to turn now to the question of Boeing. It seems as though there are a lot of problems with these MAX 737 airplanes, two of which went down in deadly incidents in recent months, as we now know. There now seems to be questions about the degree to which the FAA allowed Boeing essentially to regulate and evaluate itself. There seems to be questions about the activities of the acting Secretary of Defense, a former Boeing executive, John Harwood. And how much trouble is Boeing in right now? Not, let's be clear, the tragedy of the deaths is the most important thing. But in order to prevent deaths, we've got to make sure the system has some integrity to it. How much trouble is Boeing now in?
A lot of trouble. It is now apparent In a preliminary way. We haven't had a final investigation of either of these crashes, but it is now apparent that a software glitch that causes sensors to force the plane down when pilots are trying to make it go up is responsible for that. It can be circumvented by pilots if they're properly prepared for what to do in the event of that circumstance. But these were not problems of pilot error in the way that we normally understand that. They were not catastrophic failures of the engines of the plane. This is Boeing having a feature on this airplane that they did not properly make the pilots aware of and prepared for. So I think they've got a very large liability here. I don't know whether Patrick Shanahan has done anything that actually matters in this circumstance, although, you know, he's a former Boeing executive. I do know that the administration has put forward a new nominee to head the FAA, Steve Dixon, who is extremely well regarded in the industry as a bright, committed, principled advocate for safety. And I would expect him to have a very loud voice in this situation.
It also seems striking to me that I believe reports showed that in the Ethiopian crash that they didn't have a couple of extra safety features or instructions because they would have had to pay extra for it. That is, Boeing didn't make it standard on the aircraft that was delivered.
That's right. And Boeing is now saying they're going to provide those features free of charge. But you cannot have pilots go out with a new piece of equipment that they are not fully prepared for what the machine may do under certain circumstances. This was a foreseeable problem.
You know, one of the nation's safest forms of transport, but made incredibly scary in retrospect as we've learned more about how these planes operated. You've been hearing from Darlene Superville, John Harwood, Katie Obradovich. We want them to stick around. You stay with us. We're discussing the week's biggest stories. New Zealand bans assault rifles after a massacre. What do you make of that action? And what do you think about the Electoral College? The constitutional compromise, now a live issue on the campaign trail. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week in the news here on Folkenflik Fridays. You can join our conversation. You thought the only controversy about colleges involved admissions for rich kids or March Madness seeds? What about the Electoral College? Hit us up. Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests today are Kathy Obradovich of the Des Moines Register, Darlene Superville of the Associated Press, and John Harwood of CNBC to blatantly rip off the old Washington Monthly magazine. Just two quick tidbits and outrages. The first, the ongoing saga of our U.S. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, one revelation after another about his time as the lead federal prosecutor in Miami, where he handled, it seems in retrospect, somewhat disastrously the prosecution of a serial child predator. It turns out his office, according to the Miami Herald, prosecuted as the lead victim or prosecuted this predator, Jeffrey Epstein, for the lead victim who was 16 years old instead of one of the younger victims. The fact that the lead victim was 16 seemed to mitigate and lessen the kinds of punishments that Epstein could face. Second tidbit and outrage this week, Facebook's blog post calling keeping passwords secure. The blog post was entirely about how it had kept hundreds of millions of passwords of its users exposed in plain text to be visible by almost its entire employee staff. Kind of amazing. We're going to turn now, however, to New Zealand, where less than 1 week after a gunman stormed two mosques, killing 50 people, Muslim worshippers, Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern announced the country would ban all assault arms.
New Zealand will ban all military-style semi-automatic weapons. We will also ban all assault rifles. We will ban all high-capacity magazines.
Darlene Superville, how sweeping a move is this for a government to make, and how does this look from through the prism of American politics?
It's a very sweeping move to ban an entire class of firearms. And I think I know for myself, when I woke up and heard the news that they had done this, you know, it was sort of, wow, that fast? Because we all know here in the United States, this debate has been going on for years. And we've experienced, sadly, a number of shooting similar to what happened in New Zealand, where scores of people were killed. We had Parkland High School a little over a year ago, shootings in Texas, Orlando, Florida, just to name some that are coming to the top of my mind right now. And yet our lawmakers, our president, the debate has gone on in Congress, and there is very little movement toward the kind of ban that you see New Zealand imposing 1 week after what was their darkest day, to quote their prime minister.
Mm-hmm. I want to take a call now from Troy, Michigan, on this very topic. Jonathan Wayne here.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the air for a bit. Appreciate it. I kind of have a unique experience being both a United States citizen and also a resident of Melbourne, Australia, for a number of years dealing, you know, with this kind of issue. I guess I can see, in terms of the United States, a little bit of why the debate is a bit more convoluted than what the Prime Minister of New Zealand is trying to do. And mainly it's the fact that a lot of the definitions in terms of what is assault, what is, you know, a black gun that's scary, et cetera, is used for these types of horrible crimes. But I tend to bend a little bit more towards the United States side, being one that I've owned a firearm now. And that we deal with a lot of individuals and politicians that don't understand the functionality of any of the weapons in the first place and look at the aesthetic appearances of these kinds of weapons versus their functionality in terms of what they're used for. I found that over the years, I've been here now about 25 years, that basically the ban on that is not going to really change because the fact that criminals are still going to do criminal things. In fact, they had already shown that this person had already taken a legalized weapon and basically modified it to an extent that was illegal, in which a criminal is not going to follow those laws regardless. So I tend to see why, as unfortunate as we in the States have, you know, continual issues, you know, of course, with these types of shootings, I think that it's a knee-jerk reaction on the Prime Minister based on an area, especially New Zealand, in which you have a much, much smaller percentage of those that own firearms using them so, responsibly being affected more than anywhere in the U.S.
So, Jonathan, a different response in a different culture. I appreciate your weighing in on that. That's actually a very good perspective to share right now, Jonathan. Thank you for your call on that. Darlene, Kathy Obradovich, you've written about gun ownership and gun regulation in the country. What are you seeing in terms of attitudes toward greater gun regulation in response to some of the terrible shootings that we've experienced as a country in the last couple of years?
Well, it's interesting, David, because what's going on here in Iowa is that the over the last couple of years, the Republican majority in the legislature has been systematically dismantling gun controls and gun laws in Iowa. Excuse me. We have this year debates on whether to allow children to hunt with handguns. We have debates on requiring workplaces and courthouses to allow guns. They're trying to amend the state constitution to not only insert the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution as we know it, but also a higher legal standard to either defend or to put in place more restrictions on guns. So in Iowa, even as this – and I tell you, the debate did not slow down at all with this discussion in New Zealand. And in fact, when you see another country respond to a mass shooting by banning certain types of weapons, I think it may actually cause a sense of urgency here in Iowa among our lawmakers to hurry up and get these gun laws in place and try to protect what they consider to be the Second Amendment rights. So I really don't know where that stops in Iowa. This constitutional amendment, of course, would require a vote of the people probably in the next couple of years. So we'll see what happens here.
John Harwood, briefly, you know, there had been a lot of talk after the 2018 elections and a wave of new Democrats in Congress about, well, there was momentum now and some referenda and other kinds of laws and movement you saw in state capitals seemingly promoting a tolerance or embrace of greater regulation. Was that all talk? John? I fear we may have lost the great John Harwood. We will labor to get him back. Darlene Superville, is it your sense that there is any more sort of momentum there for gun control, or is that something that actually seems to have waned?
I think there may be some momentum for it in the House of Representatives in Washington, for example. I believe they did recently vote on some gun legislation, but as much enthusiasm as the new Democratic controlled House has for doing something on the gun issue, which hasn't really been tackled in a number of years, you have the Senate that is still controlled by Republicans. So anything the House does with all their enthusiasm behind it is going to run into a roadblock in the Senate.
Terrific. I want to now turn to the question of the greater elections. The lead up to 2020 has already begun, and you've started to see a number of candidates on the Democratic side question the appropriateness of the Electoral College. During a CNN town hall this week, Massachusetts Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren said, "Let's go through a national popular vote instead."
Every vote matters. And the way we can make that happen is that we can have national voting, and that means get rid of the Electoral College.
Meanwhile, President Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, who's been campaigning for the president, defended the Electoral College. She spoke with Fox News host Sandra Smith.
Let's just talk about the fact that the Electoral College was put in place to make sure that the middle of the country was not forgotten. Otherwise, Sandra, people would campaign in New York and L.A., and that's all they would do. They'd go to the big cities. They'd forget about the real people of this country, the rural people in the middle.
Darlene Superville, this would require constitutional, you know, amendment. This would require changing the rules of the road. There seems to be some heat about this because, you know, President Trump was elected with a minority of votes. George W. Bush was elected with minority votes. And it seems as though people on the left are saying, are we going to be squeezed out of having what we consider to be the popular will reflected?
That's exactly right. And you're correct when you say that it would require changing the Constitution. And that in and of itself would be a Herculean effort to get that done. So folks like Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg and some of the others who are talking about this, Beto O'Rourke and Kamala Harris, who are talking about this, it's probably more just to kind of appease the base, you know, tell the base, you know, I'm with you on this, I support you, you know, I'll push for this. But the reality is that it would take a lot of work to get something like that done. And the clip that you played from Lara Trump, President Trump is fond of talking about how many votes he won in the Electoral College over Hillary Clinton. It's not something that he would support either.
Yes, go ahead. I was going to ask how it's playing there in Iowa.
Yeah, it's interesting here in Iowa because we are part of the middle of the country that would be, frankly, benefits from the Electoral College. Iowa gets outsized attention not only in the primary season because of the caucuses, but during the general elections because Iowa has been one of those swing states, the battlegrounds. And so it matters more than just its electoral votes. The opportunity that Iowa has is more because of the Electoral College, I think, than anything. If you just have campaigns based on money and who can do well in large population centers, that does leave states like Iowa in the lurch. And yet you have Democrats who are just as enthusiastic here about doing away with the Electoral College because they perceive that the Electoral College as it stands benefits Republicans. I honestly think it would be a lot easier, instead of just trying to amend the Constitution, it would be easier for Democrats to try to find ways to reach people in rural areas again and figure out how to win elections in those states as opposed to just trying to mess with the system.
I want to turn now to some of the people on the hustings to talk a little bit about some new entrants or some new, at least semi-official entrants. Beto O'Rourke has been swanning his way through Iowa and other places. Joe Biden is making increasingly clear that that the former vice president is going to run. John Harwood, these guys, and I do mean guys, are attracting a lot of attention, even as some other seemingly fairly substantive candidates have been in the race. Tell me how plausible each one is as a standard bearer for the Democrats.
Well, I think most of the candidates in the race are plausible standard bearers for the Democrats. I think the most problematic from a Democratic perspective of the major candidates may be Bernie Sanders, because I think he's been pretty far out there on some issues in a way that might complicate his ability to win a general election. I think Joe Biden would be a viable candidate if he could get through the Democratic primary, which I have doubts about. Don't know if he's going to get in the race.
You don't think he's even going to actually enter?
I have assumed all along that he would not enter because he would come to the conclusion that his campaign within the Democratic primary was not going to be successful. Now, the reports that we get seem to indicate that he is leaning into the idea of running, but the longer he delays, the more it would suggest that he's got some doubts about it. Now, he has time because he's very well known and could probably assemble a team quickly and raise money quickly and all that sort of thing. So I don't purport to have knowledge of that. I'm just saying that on the face of the circumstances, given his age, given the previous races that he's run, given the dynamism among younger Democrats and the way the party is going younger, generally speaking, I think it would be a major challenge for him. I think Kamala Harris is an extremely viable candidate on the Democratic side. I think Beto O'Rourke is as well. And then you've got people like Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Cory Booker, others who are going to be players in this race. And it's the most unpredictable Democratic race that I can remember because the barriers to entry have gotten reduced. People can build online followings, both financially and otherwise. So I think Kathy's got her hands full of sitting out there in Iowa and watching them come beg for her favor. I'm not sure she's going to have any time on her calendar for anything other than this race.
And then Kathy Obradovich, in the last, call it 30 seconds we have left for you, Beto O'Rourke gathered, I think, over $6 million in his first day or so of announcing from small donors just sort of instantaneously. Does this mean anything on the ground in Iowa, or does it just mean, hey, he was able to get a lot of money online?
Well, I think that it's a mark of legitimacy when you're able to raise money. I think we saw that 4 years ago when Bernie Sanders started amassing money from small donors. You know, it's a mark of energy. It's a mark of excitement. People here in Iowa, I think, are sort of sitting back. I don't know for sure that they really know what to make yet of Beto O'Rourke. Certainly, they're interested in him. They showed up and packed his events here this past week. I think they're kind of embracing the quirkiness of him. Our paper ran a photo gallery of Beto O'Rourke standing on things. He's known
Beto
to stand
O'Rourke,
on.
Embrace the quirk, a strong campaign slogan if ever I heard one. Kathy
yes.
Obradovich, opinion editor and columnist for the Des Moines Register, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Darlene Superville, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Darlene, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And John Harwood, thanks for coming back. I was worried about the Viking funeral we were going to have. You can continue our conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My name is David Folkenflik. This show is On Point.